This is Audible.
An ACE test and questionnaire can be found in the PDF that accompanies this program. Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Deepest Well, Healing the Long-Term Effects of Childhood Adversity by Dr. Nadine Burke Harris. Read by the author.
Author's note. All of the stories in this book are true. Names and identifying details of some individuals have been changed in some circumstances to protect confidentiality. Some vignettes are retold from previous published works. Introduction. At 5 o'clock on an ordinary Saturday morning, a 43-year-old man, we'll call him Evan, wakes up. His wife, Sarah, is breathing softly beside him, curled in her usual position, arms slung over her forehead. Without thinking much about it, Evan tries to roll over and slide out of bed to get to the bathroom. But something's off. He can't roll over, and it feels like his right arm has gone numb.
Ugh, must have slept on it too long, he thinks, bracing himself for those mean, hot tingles you get when the circulation starts again.
He tries to wiggle his fingers to get the blood flowing, but no dice. The aching pressure in his bladder isn't going to wait, though, so he tries again to get up. Nothing happens. What the? His right leg is exactly where he left it, despite the fact that he tried to move it the same way that he's been moving it all his life, without thinking. He tries again. Nope. Looks like this morning it doesn't want to cooperate. It's weird, this whole body not doing what you want it to thing, but the urge to pee feels like a much bigger problem right now. Hey, baby, can you help me? I gotta pee. Just push me out of bed so I don't do it right here, he says to Sarah, half-joking about the last part. What's wrong, Evan? Says Sarah, lifting her head and squinting at him. Evan? Her voice rises as she says his name the second time. He notices that she's looking at him with deep concern in her eyes. Her face wears the expression she gets when the boys have fevers or wake up sick in the middle of the night. Which is ridiculous, because all he needs is a little push. It's 5 in the morning, after all. No need for a full-blown conversation. Honey, I just gotta pee, he says. What's wrong? Evan, what's wrong? In an instant, Sarah is up. She's got the lights on and is peering into Evan's face as though she's reading a shocking headline in the Sunday paper. It's all right, baby. I just need to pee. My leg is asleep. Can you help me real quick? He says. He figures that maybe if he can just put some pressure on his left side, he can shift position and jumpstart his circulation. He just needs to get out of bed. It is in that moment that he realizes that it isn't just his right arm and leg that are numb. It's his face, too. In fact, it's his whole right side. What's happening to me? Then Evan feels something warm and wet on his left leg. He looks down to see his boxers are soaked. Urine is seeping into the bedsheets. Oh my God! Sarah screams. In that instant, seeing her husband wet the bed, Sarah realizes the gravity of the situation and leaps into action. She jumps out of bed, and Evan can hear her running to their teenage son's bedroom. There are a few muffled words that he can't make out through the wall, and then she's back. She sits on the bed next to him, holding him and caressing his face. You're okay, she says. It's gonna be okay. Her voice is soft and soothing. Babe, what's going on? Evan asks, looking at his wife. As he gazes up at her, it dawns on him that she can't understand anything he's saying. His lips are moving, and words are coming out of his mouth, but she doesn't seem to be getting any of it. Just then, a ridiculous cartoon commercial with a dancing heart bouncing along to a silly song starts playing in his mind. F stands for face drooping, bounce, bounce. A stands for arm weakness, bounce, bounce. S stands for speech difficulty. T stands for time to call 911. Learn to identify the signs of stroke. Act fast. Holy crap. Despite the early hour, Evan's son Marcus comes briskly to the doorway and hands his mom the phone. As father and son lock eyes, Evan sees a look of alarm and worry that makes his heart clench in his chest. He tries to tell his son it will be okay, but it's clear from the boy's expression that his attempt at reassurance is only making things worse. Marcus's face contorts with fear, and tears start streaming down his cheeks. On the phone with the 911 operator, Sarah is clear and forceful. "I need an ambulance right now. Right now. My husband is having a stroke." "Yes, I'm sure. He can't move his entire right side. Half his face won't move." "No, he can't speak. It's totally garbled. His speech doesn't make any sense. Just hurry up. Please, send an ambulance right away." The first responders, a team of paramedics, make it there inside of 5 minutes. They bang on the door and ring the doorbell. Sarah runs downstairs and lets them in. Their younger son is still in his bedroom, asleep, and she's worried that the noise will wake him, but fortunately, he doesn't stir. Evan stares up at the crown molding and tries to calm down. He feels himself starting to drift off, getting further away from the current moment. This isn't good. The next thing he knows, he's on a stretcher, being carried down the stairs. As the paramedics negotiate the landing, they pause to shift positions. In that slice of second, Evan glances up and catches one of the medics watching him with an expression that makes him go cold. It's a look of recognition and pity. It says, "Poor guy, I've seen this before, and it ain't good." As they are passing through the doorway, Evan wonders whether he will ever come back to this house. Back to Sarah and his boys. From the way that medic looked at him, Evan thinks the answer might not be yes. When they get to the emergency room, Sarah is peppered with questions about Evan's medical history. She tells them every detail of Evan's life that she thinks may be relevant. He's a computer programmer. He goes mountain biking every weekend. He loves playing basketball with his boys. He's a great dad. He's happy. At his last checkup, the doctor said everything looked great. At one point, she overhears one of the doctors relating Evan's case to a colleague over the phone. 43-year-old male, non-smoker, no risk factors. But unbeknownst to Sarah, Evan, and even Evan's doctors, he did have a risk factor. A mighty big one. In fact, Evan was more than twice as likely to have a stroke as a person without this risk factor. What no one in the ER that day knew was that for decades, an invisible biological process had been at work, one involving Evan's cardiovascular, immune, and endocrine systems, one that might very well have led up to the events of this moment. The risk factor and its potential impact never came up in all of the regular checkups Evan had had over the years. What put Evan at increased risk for waking up with half of his body paralyzed, and for numerous other diseases as well, is not rare. It's something that 2/3 of the nation's population is exposed to. Something that's so common, it's hidden in plain sight. So what is it? Lead? Asbestos? Some toxic packaging material? It's childhood adversity. Most people wouldn't suspect that what happens to them in childhood has anything to do with stroke or heart disease or cancer. But many of us do recognize that when someone experiences childhood trauma, there may be an emotional and psychological impact. For the unlucky, or some say the weak, we know what the worst of the fallout looks like. Substance abuse, cyclical violence, incarceration, and mental health problems. But for everyone else, childhood trauma is the bad memory that no one talks about until at least the fifth or sixth date. It's just drama. Baggage. Childhood adversity is a story we think we know. Children have faced trauma and stress in the form of abuse, neglect, violence, and fear since God was a boy. Parents have been getting trashed, getting arrested, and getting divorced for almost as long. The people who are smart and strong enough are able to rise above the past and triumph through the force of their own will and resilience. Or are they? We've all heard the Horatio Alger-like stories about people who have experienced early hardships and have either overcome or, better yet, been made stronger by them. These tales are embedded in Americans' cultural DNA. At best, they paint an incomplete picture of what childhood adversity means for the hundreds of millions of people in the United States and the billions around the world who have experienced early life stress. More often, they take on moral overtones, provoking feelings of shame and hopelessness in those who struggle with the lifelong impacts of childhood adversity. But there's a huge part of the story missing. 20 years of medical research has shown that childhood adversity literally gets under our skin, changing people in ways that can endure in their bodies for decades. It can tip a child's developmental trajectory and affect physiology. It can trigger chronic inflammation and hormonal changes that can last a lifetime. It can alter the way DNA is read and how cells replicate. And it can dramatically increase the risk for heart disease, stroke, cancer, diabetes, even Alzheimer's. This new science gives a startling twist to the Horatio Alger tale we think we know so well. As studies reveal, years later, after having transcended adversity in amazing ways, even bootstrap heroes find themselves pulled up short by their biology. Despite rough childhoods, plenty of folks got good grades and went to college and had families. They did what they were supposed to do. They overcame adversity and went on to build successful lives. And then they got sick. They had strokes, or got lung cancer, or developed heart disease, or sank into depression. Since they hadn't engaged in any high-risk behavior, like drinking, overeating, or smoking, they had no idea where their health problems had come from. They certainly didn't connect them to the past, because they left the past behind, right? The truth is that despite all their hard work, people like Evan, who have had adverse childhood experiences, are still at greater risk for developing chronic illnesses like cardiovascular disease and cancer. But why? How does exposure to stress in childhood crop up as a health problem in middle age or even retirement? Are there effective treatments? What can we do to protect our health and our children's health? In 2005, when I finished my pediatrics residency at Stanford, I didn't even know to ask these questions. Like everyone else, I had only part of the story. But then, whether by chance or by fate, I caught glimpses of a story yet to be told. It started in exactly the place where you might expect to find high levels of adversity, a low-income community of color with few resources, tucked inside a wealthy city with all the resources in the world. In the Bayview Hunters Point neighborhood of San Francisco, I started a community pediatric clinic. Every day, I witness my tiny patients dealing with overwhelming trauma and stress. As a human being, I was brought to my knees by it. As a scientist and a doctor, I got up off those knees and began asking questions. My journey gave me, and I hope this book will give you, a radically different perspective on the story of childhood adversity. The whole story, not just the one we think we know. Through these pages, you will better understand how childhood adversity may be playing out in your life or in the life of someone you love. And more important, you will learn the tools for healing that begins with one person or one community, but has the power to transform the health of nations. Part 1. Discovery. Chapter 1. Something's just not right. As I walked into an exam room at the Bayview Child Health Center to meet my next patient, I couldn't help but smile. My team and I had worked hard to make the clinic as inviting and family-friendly as possible. The room was painted in pastel colors and had a matching checkered floor. Cartoons of baby animals paraded across the wall above the sink and marched towards the door. If you didn't know better, you'd think you were in a pediatric office in the affluent Pacific Heights neighborhood of San Francisco instead of struggling Bayview, which was exactly the point. We wanted our clinic to be a place where people felt valued. When I came through the door, Diego's eyes were glued to the baby giraffes. What a super cutie, I thought, as he moved his attention to me, flashed me a smile, and checked me out through a mop of shaggy black hair. He was perched on the chair next to his mother, who held his 3-year-old sister in her lap. When I asked him to climb up onto the exam table, he obediently hopped up and started swinging his legs back and forth. As I opened his chart, I saw his birth date and looked up at him again. Diego was a cutie and a shorty. Quickly, I flipped through the chart, looking for some objective data to back up my initial impression. I plotted Diego's height on the growth curve, and then I double-checked to be sure I hadn't made a mistake. My newest patient was at the 50th percentile for height for a 4-year-old, which would have been fine, except Diego was 7 years old. That's weird, I thought, because otherwise, Diego looked like a totally normal kid. I scooted my chair over to the table and pulled out my stethoscope. As I got closer, I could see thickened, dry patches of eczema at the creases of his elbows. And when I listened to his lungs, I heard a distinct wheezing. Diego's school nurse had referred him for evaluation for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, a chronic condition characterized by hyperactivity, inattention, and impulsivity. Whether or not Diego was one of the millions of children affected by ADHD remained to be seen. But already, I could see his primary diagnoses would be more along the lines of persistent asthma, eczema, and growth failure. Diego's mom, Rosa, watched nervously as I examined her son. Her eyes were fixed on Diego and filled with concern. Little Selena's gaze was darting around the room as she checked out all the shiny gadgets. "Do you prefer English or Espanol?" I asked Rosa. Relief crossed her face, and she leaned forward. After we talked, in Spanish, through the medical history that she had filled out in the waiting room, I asked the same question I always do before jumping into the results of my physical exam. Is there anything specific going on that I should know about? Concern gathered in her forehead like a stitch. "He's not doing well in school, and the nurse said that medicine could help. Is that true? What medicine does he need? When did you notice that he started having trouble in school?" I asked. There was a slight pause as her face morphed from tense to tearful. Ay, doctora, she said, and began the story in a torrent of Spanish. I put my hand on her arm, and before she could get much further, I poked my head out the door and asked my medical assistant to take Selena and Diego to the waiting room. The story that I heard from Rosa was not a happy one. She spent the next 10 minutes telling me about an incident of sexual abuse that had happened to Diego when he was 4 years old. Rosa and her husband had taken in a tenant to help offset the sky-high San Francisco rent. It was a family friend, someone her husband knew from his work in construction. Rosa noticed that Diego became more clingy and withdrawn after the man arrived, but she had no idea why, until she came home one day to find the man in the shower with Diego. While they had immediately kicked the man out and filed a police report, the damage was done. Diego started having trouble in preschool, and as he moved up, he lagged further and further behind academically. Making matters worse, Rosa's husband blamed himself and seemed angry all of the time. While he had always drunk more than she liked, after the incident, it got a lot worse. She recognized the tension and drinking weren't good for the family, but didn't know what she could do about it. From what she told me about her state of mind, I strongly suspected she was suffering from depression. I assured her that we would help Diego with asthma and eczema, and I'd look into the ADHD and growth failure. She sighed and seemed at least a little relieved. We sat in silence for a moment, my mind zooming around. I believed, ever since we'd opened the clinic in 2007, that something medical was happening with my patients that I couldn't quite understand. It started with the glut of ADHD cases that were referred to me. As with Diego's, most of my patients' ADHD symptoms didn't just come out of the blue. They seemed to occur at the highest rates in patients who were struggling with some type of life disruption or trauma, like the twins who were failing classes and getting into fights at school after witnessing an attempted murder in their home, or the three brothers whose grades fell precipitously after their parents' divorce turned violently acrimonious, to the point where the family was ordered by the court to do their custody swaps at the Bayview police station. Many patients were already on ADHD medication. Some were even on antipsychotics. For a number of patients, the medication seemed to be helping. But for many, it clearly wasn't. Most of the time, I couldn't make the ADHD diagnosis. The diagnostic criteria for ADHD told me that I had to rule out other explanations for ADHD symptoms, such as pervasive developmental disorders, schizophrenia, or other psychotic disorders, before I could diagnose ADHD. But what if there was a more nuanced answer? What if the cause of these symptoms, the poor impulse control, inability to focus, difficulty sitting still, was not a mental disorder exactly, but a biological process that worked on the brain to disrupt normal functioning? Weren't mental disorders simply biological disorders? Trying to treat these children felt like jamming unmatched puzzle pieces together. The symptoms, causes, and treatments were close, but not close enough to give that satisfying click. I mentally scrolled back, cataloging all the patients like Diego and the twins that I'd seen over the past year. My mind went immediately to Kayla, a 10-year-old whose asthma was particularly difficult to control. After the last flare-up, I sat down with mom and patient to meticulously review Kayla's medication regimen. When I asked if Kayla's mom could think of any asthma triggers that we hadn't already identified, we had reviewed everything from pet hair to cockroaches to cleaning products. She responded, "Well, Her asthma does seem to get worse every time her dad punches a hole in the wall. Do you think that could be related? Kayla and Diego were just two patients, but they had plenty of company. Day after day, I saw infants who were listless and had strange rashes. I saw kindergartners whose hair was falling out. Epidemic levels of learning and behavior problems. Kids just entering middle school had depression. And in unique cases, like Diego's, kids weren't even growing. As I recalled their faces, I ran an accompanying mental checklist of disorders, diseases, syndromes, and conditions. The kind of early setbacks that could send disastrous ripples throughout the lives to come. If you look through a certain percentage of my charts, you would see not only a plethora of medical problems, but story after story of heart-wrenching trauma. In addition to the blood pressure reading and the body mass index in the chart, if you flipped all the way to the social history section, you would find parental incarcerations, multiple foster care placements, suspected physical abuse, documented abuse, and family legacies of mental illness and substance abuse. A week before Diego, I had seen a 6-year-old girl with type 1 diabetes, whose dad was high for the third visit in a row. When I asked him about it, he assured me that I shouldn't worry because the weed helped quiet the voices in his head. In the first year of my practice, seeing roughly 1,000 patients, I diagnosed not one, but two kids with autoimmune hepatitis, a rare disorder that typically affects fewer than 3 children in 100,000. Both cases coincided with significant histories of adversity. I asked myself again and again, what's the connection? If it had just been a handful of kids with both overwhelming adversity and poor health outcomes, then maybe I could have seen it as a coincidence. But Diego's situation was representative of hundreds of kids that I'd seen over the past year. The phrase statistical significance kept echoing through my head. Every day, I drove home with a hollow feeling. I was doing my best to care for these kids, but it wasn't nearly enough. There was an underlying sickness in Bayview that I couldn't put my finger on. And with every Diego that I saw, the gnawing in my stomach got worse. For a long time, the possibility of an actual biological link between childhood adversity and damaged health came to me as a question that lingered for only a moment before it was gone. I wonder, what if it seems like these questions kept popping up, but part of the problem in putting the pieces together was that they would emerge from situations occurring months or sometimes years apart. Because they didn't fit logically or neatly into my worldview at those discrete moments in time, it was difficult to see the story behind the story. Later, it would feel obvious that all of these questions were simply clues pointing to a deeper truth. But like a soap opera wife whose husband is stepping out with the nanny, I would understand it only in hindsight. It wasn't hotel receipts or whiffs of perfume that clued me in, but there were plenty of tiny signals that eventually led me to the same thought. How could I not have seen this? It was right in front of me the whole damn time. I lived in that state of not quite getting it for years, because I was doing my job the way I had been trained to do it. I knew that my gut feeling about this biological connection between adversity and health was just a hunch. As a scientist, I couldn't accept those kinds of associations without some serious evidence. Yes, my patients were experiencing extremely poor health outcomes, but wasn't that endemic to the community they lived in? Both my medical training and my public health education told me that this was so. That there is a connection between poor health and poor communities is well documented. We know that it's not just how you live that affects your health. It's also where you live. Public health experts and researchers refer to communities as hotspots if poor health outcomes on the whole are found to be extreme in comparison to the statistical norm. The dominant view is that health disparities in populations like Bayview occur because these folks have poor access to health care, poor quality of care, and poor options when it comes to things like healthy, affordable food, and safe housing. When I was at Harvard getting my master's degree in public health, I learned that if I wanted to improve people's health, the best thing I could do was find a way to provide accessible care and better health care for these communities. Straight out of my medical residency, I was recruited by the California Pacific Medical Center, CPMC, in the Laurel Heights area of San Francisco to do my dream job: create programs specifically targeted to address health disparities in the city. The hospital's CEO, Dr. Martin Brotman, personally sat me down to reinforce his commitment to that. My second week on the job, my boss came into my office and handed me a 147-page document, the 2004 Community Health Assessment for San Francisco. Then, he promptly went on vacation, giving me very little direction and leaving me to my own ambitious devices. In hindsight, this was either genius or crazy on his part. I did what any good public health nerd would do. I looked at the numbers and tried to assess the situation. I had heard that Bayview Hunters Point in San Francisco, where much of San Francisco's African-American population lived, was a vulnerable community. But when I looked at the 2004 assessment, I was floored. One way the report grouped people was by their zip code. The leading cause of early death in 17 out of 21 zip codes in San Francisco was ischemic heart disease, which is the number one killer in the United States. In 3 zip codes, it was HIV/AIDS. But Bayview Hunters Point was the only zip code where the number one cause of early death was violence. Right next to Bayview, 94124, in the table was a zip code for the Marina District, 94123, one of the city's more affluent neighborhoods. As I ran my finger down the rows of numbers, my jaw dropped. What they showed me is that if you were a parent raising your baby in the Bayview zip code, your child was 2.5 times as likely to develop pneumonia than a child in the Marina District. Your child was also 6 times as likely to develop asthma. And once that baby grew up, he or she was 12 times as likely to develop uncontrolled diabetes. I had been hired by CPMC to address disparities. And boy, now I saw why. Looking back, I think it was probably a combination of naivete and youthful enthusiasm that spurred me to spend the 2 weeks that my boss was gone drawing up a business plan for a clinic in the heart of the community with the greatest need. I wanted to bring services to the people of Bayview rather than asking them to come to us. Luckily, when my boss and I gave the plan to Dr. Brotman, he didn't fire me for excessive idealism. Instead, he helped me make the clinic a reality, which still kind of blows my mind. The numbers in that report had given me a good idea of what the people of Bayview were up against. But it wasn't until March of 2007 when we opened the doors to CPMC's Bayview Child Health Center that I saw the full shape of it. To say that life in Bayview isn't easy would be an understatement. It's one of the few places in San Francisco where drug deals happen in plain sight of kindergartners on their way to school, and where grandmas sometimes sleep in bathtubs because they're afraid of stray bullets coming through the walls. It's always been a rough place, and not only because of violence. In the 1960s, the U.S. Navy decontaminated radioactive boats in the shipyard. And up until the early 2000s, the toxic byproducts from a nearby power plant were routinely dumped in the area. In a documentary about racial strife and marginalization of the neighborhood, writer and social critic James Baldwin said, "This is the San Francisco that America pretends doesn't exist." My day-to-day experience working in Bayview tells me that the struggles are real and ever-present. But it also tells me that's not the whole story. Bayview is the oily concrete you skin your knee on, but it's also the flower growing up between the cracks. Every day, I see families and communities that lovingly support each other through some of the toughest experiences imaginable. I see beautiful kids and doting parents. They struggle, and they laugh, and then they struggle some more. But no matter how hard parents work for their kids, the lack of resources in the community is crushing. Before we opened the Bayview Child Health Center, there was only one pediatrician in practice for over 10,000 children. These kids face some serious medical and emotional problems. So do their parents and their grandparents. In many cases, the kids fare better because they're eligible for government-assisted health insurance. Poverty, violence, substance abuse, and crime have created a multi-generational legacy of ill health and frustration. But still, I believed we could make a difference. I opened my practice there because I wasn't okay with pretending the people of Bayview didn't exist. Patients like Diego and Kayla were exactly why I came to Bayview. For as long as I could remember, I knew this was the problem I wanted to focus on, the type of community I wanted to serve. I had gotten the best medical education I could, earned a master's degree in public health, and was well-trained in how to work with vulnerable communities to improve access to healthcare. After years of schooling, I had faith in the dominant academic view. If you improve people's access to quality healthcare, you will move the needle towards better health. I knew what boxes to check, and I was ready to go. When I first got to Bayview, I thought all I had to do was put it in motion, start giving people great care, make it easy for them to get it affordably, and watch that needle move towards healthier kids. It seemed simple enough. There was some pretty basic care that we could quickly implement, and by employing standard clinical protocols, our clinic was able to dramatically improve outcomes on some things, like increasing immunization rates and decreasing asthma hospitalizations. So I was feeling pretty good for a while. But then, as I was handing out vaccines and inhalers, I started to wonder, if we were doing everything right, why didn't we see any indication that we could make a dent in this community's dramatically reduced life expectancy? My patients kept coming back with high rates of illnesses, and I had the sinking feeling that when they grew up, their kids would keep coming back too. Despite the check boxes, despite the great care, and despite more healthcare access than the community had seen in a generation, the needle in Bayview only bounced. After my medical assistant had taken Diego and his sister into the waiting room, and Rosa had told me some of his story, the two of us sat momentarily with our thoughts. I could only imagine the guilt, worry, and hope swimming around in her head. Regardless of our individual thought soups, both of our faces cracked into helpless smiles when Diego slid through the door, cross-eyed and goofy. Rosa stood up, and I took note of her size. She was a stout woman, but height-wise, she wasn't below the range of normal. Diego, on the other hand, was so small that he didn't even come close to the growth curve for a 7-year-old boy. I remember mentally clicking through the protocol for evaluation and treatment of growth failure, which makes sense. That's what doctors do. You see a problem, abnormal development or disease, and you try to right the ship. But this time, a simple question surfaced. What am I missing? There's a widely known parable that students all learn on day one of public health school, and it happens to be based on a true story. In late August 1854, there was a severe cholera outbreak in London. The Broad Street area in Soho was the epicenter, with 127 dead in the first 3 days, and more than 500 dead by the second week of September. Back then, the dominant theory was that diseases like cholera and bubonic plague were spread through unhealthy air. John Snow, a London physician, was skeptical of this miasma theory of disease. By canvassing the residents of the Broad Street neighborhood, he was able to deduce the pattern of the disease. Incidences were all clustered around a water source, a public well with a hand pump. When Snow convinced local officials to disable the well by removing the pump's handle, the outbreak subsided. At the time, no one wanted to accept Snow's hypothesis that the disease was spread not through the air, but by the more unpleasant fecal-oral route. But a few decades later, science would catch up to him, and the miasma theory would be replaced by germ theory. As budding public health crusaders, my classmates and I focused on the sexy part of the parable of the well, the bit where Snow topples the miasma theory. But I also took away a larger lesson. If 100 people all drink from the same well, and 98 of them develop diarrhea, I can write prescription after prescription for antibiotics, or I can stop and ask, what the hell is in this well? I had been about to walk past the well to do the standard evaluation for Diego's growth failure, but this time, something made me think about the case in front of me a little differently. Maybe it was the extreme presentation. Maybe I had finally seen enough cases to start putting the pieces together. Whatever the reason, I couldn't get away from the nagging feeling that Diego's terrible trauma and his health problems weren't just a coincidence. But before I could look into the well for the answer to Diego's or any of my patients' problems, I needed a few more data points. The first step in Diego's case was to order a bone age study, an X-ray of the left wrist that can be used to determine a child's skeletal maturation based on the size and shape of the bones. After drawing some labs and requesting his growth charts from the clinic where he had previously been seen, I handed Rosa the order for the X-ray and sent my newest patient on his way. Days later, I received the report from the radiologist. It confirmed that Diego's skeletal maturation was consistent with that of a 4-year-old. But Diego's labs didn't show low levels of growth hormone or any other hormone that might account for why he wasn't growing. I had some important data in front of me. The trauma had happened at age 4, and he had gained very little vertical height since then. He also had the bone age of a 4-year-old. But by all accounts, Diego wasn't malnourished and didn't have any evidence of a hormonal disorder. There didn't seem to be a readily available medical explanation for Diego's stature. My next call was to Dr. Suruchi Bhatia, a pediatric endocrinologist at California Pacific Medical Center. I sent her the X-ray report and Diego's labs and asked whether she thought the sexual assault of a 4-year-old could lead to that child's growth arrest. Is that even something you've seen before? I asked, finally verbalizing what had been bugging me all week. The not-so-simple answer? Yes. Oh, man, I thought. Now I really have to find out what the hell is going on. I couldn't stop thinking about how extreme this physical presentation was. If what was in the well in Bayview was adversity, Diego had experienced a high dose of it, the equivalent of drinking a jug of cholera-infested water. If I could figure out what was going on with Diego on a biochemical level, maybe I would learn what was going on with all of my patients. Maybe it was even the key to what was going on in the community at large. I had four major questions to answer. Was the exposure, trauma, or adversity at the bottom of the well making people sick? How? Could I prove it? And most important, what could I do about it medically? One immediate problem with getting to the bottom of this larger connection between adversity and ill health was that at times there was an overwhelming number of factors to consider. My patients' different upbringings, their genetic histories, their environmental exposures, and, of course, their individual traumas. I already knew it wasn't going to be as simple as identifying a shared water source and a single type of bacterium. With Diego, an incident of abuse had acted as a catalyst that presumably set off a biochemical chain reaction that resulted in growth arrest. But all kinds of wild things had to go on and keep going on, hormonally and cellularly, for the body to react in such an extreme way. Figuring this out would take some doing.
I saw the next months of my life flash in front of me. It was nothing but PubMed, granola bars, and eye strain.
That day in clinic, I stayed well until the evening, combing through patient charts for patterns I might have missed. Eventually, I got up and began to pace. All of the patients and staff had gone home, so I was free to wander without distraction. I meandered through the waiting room, stopping to smile at the mini furniture and the primary colored footprints stenciled on the rug. These things reminded me, yet again, that my patients were normal kids, regardless of what they'd been through or would go through. When I first started working for CPMC in Laurel Heights, my favorite part of the job was examining newborns. Years later, I did identical exams on the newborns of Bayview, and I found that their little hearts sounded the same under my stethoscope. When I put a gloved finger into an infant's mouth, the same adorable suckling reflex kicked in. They all had the same soft spots on the tops of their heads, where the skull bones hadn't quite closed yet. These babies came into the world no different than the ones born in Laurel Heights. Yet as I did newborn exams in Bayview, I knew that these human beings' lives would, according to the statistics, be 12 years shorter than the lives of the children in Laurel Heights. Not because their hearts were made differently or because their kidneys didn't function the same way, but because somewhere in the future, something in their bodies would change. Something that would alter the trajectory of their health for the rest of their lives. At the beginning, they are equal, these beautiful bundles of potential. And knowing that they won't always be is enough to break your heart. I walked into the exam room just before leaving for home, flipped on the light, and looked at the animals stenciled on the wall. Lions, giraffes, horses, and strangely, a single, solitary frog. My gaze lingered there. Maybe it was that the frog was oddly solo, or maybe it was just the brain's mysterious way of connecting the dots, but suddenly I remembered the Hayes Lab at the University of California, Berkeley. When I was 20 years old, I had logged some serious hours there, and frogs were a big part of it. The Hayes Lab was an amphibian research lab where the inimitable Dr. Tyrone Hayes was studying the effects of corticosteroids, stress hormones, on tadpoles at different stages of their development. The ghosts of research past flooded my brain, intersecting with the problem I'd been fighting all day. Everything I'd learned in my training told me that adversity was a social determinant of poor health outcomes. But what was never examined was how it affected physiology or biological mechanisms. There wasn't any research that I could fall back on to help me understand how my patients' traumatic experiences could be affecting their biology and their health. Or maybe there was. Maybe, to figure out what was going on with Diego and all the little tadpoles in Bayview, I had to look for clues in more cold-blooded circles. Chapter 2. To go forward, go back. If it's true that parents are a child's first teacher, the fact that my dad was a professor of biochemistry who had a penchant for instructive chaos probably says a lot about me. At one point in the 80s, my parents were raising 5 kids under the age of 10, so we probably left them little choice but to get creative on the parenting front. My father, Dr. Basil Burke, is a Jamaican immigrant. And, if I can dad brag here for a second, when the Institute of Jamaica gave out the Centennial Medal to honor its 100th anniversary, Bob Marley got one for music, and my dad got one for chemistry. To this day, when he babysits my kids, I never know what I'm coming home to. A mysterious, chalky white substance coating every inch of the stove? A carefully deconstructed water filter? 3 raw shrimp on the counter next to 3 cooked shrimp? It's always a surprise with my pops. I knew from an early age that he wasn't like other dads. As a biochemist, he turned every one of our kid experiments into an opportunity, demand, for discovery. When he came home from work to find me and my 4 brothers lobbing sharp-nosed paper airplanes at one another with wild glee, he didn't yell at us to stop before we poke someone's eye out. Instead, he sprang into action, commanding us to take measurements on the floor and time our throws. If you calculated how long it took an airplane to get from point A to point B, you could determine its velocity. And from that, knowing that gravity caused an object to accelerate at 9.8 meters per second squared, you could determine the lift under the wings and extrapolate the best angle at which to release the plane in order to hit someone. In hindsight, I see that this kind of intervention was actually brilliant parenting, because inevitably, my brothers would groan, drop their weapons, and get the hell out of there. I, on the other hand, couldn't get enough. My dad brought physics, chemistry, and biology to bear on everything from curdled milk in the fridge to the curry stain on my blouse that mysteriously turned from yellow to purple the minute I touched it with a bar of soap. While my mother was none too pleased about the stench of sour milk or a ruined blouse, I learned something that became fundamental to my worldview: that there is a molecular mechanism behind every natural phenomenon. You just have to look for it. A decade later, during my internship in the Hayes Lab, I realized that a big part of what made my dad a great scientist was the intense joy he took in the process. I'd come to understand that doing science as a professional was not the same as blowing stuff up as a kid. There was a whole lot of mind-numbing, pipetting, and data entry, so it was easy to miss the forest for the trees. But the best scientists didn't. They used their excitement and enthusiasm as a bridge from the mundane to the revelatory. If you approach your experiments simply as plug and play, either they work or they don't, then you're missing the potential for a happy accident. Day to day, good scientists actively engineer the conditions for discovery by making the most of accidents. Like my curry-stained blouse, a botched experiment could be a gateway to an unexpected truth. As a kid, I saw how this worked by watching my dad. As a college student, I learned it at the hands of Dr. Tyrone B. Hayes. Dr. Hayes was the antithesis of the typical Berkeley science professor. Just 27 years old at the time I worked under him, he was one of the youngest professors on the science faculty. Not only was he brilliant, he was my only African-American science professor at Cal, and he happened to have a wicked sense of humor and an eloquently foul mouth. No one even called him Dr. Hayes. He was just straight up Tyrone. Thanks to him, ours was by far the coolest lab in the building. The Hayes Lab specialized in groundbreaking amphibian endocrine research. So naturally, tadpoles and toads were my life for every spare hour of my senior year at Berkeley. The research I was working on would turn out to be one of Hayes's most important accidents. Hayes's experiment started with a hypothesis about sexual development in toads and was designed to figure out the impact of different kinds of steroid hormones, testosterone, estrogen, corticosterone, on gonadal differentiation. Basically, whether tadpoles would develop into female or male adult toads. Hormones are an organism's chemical messengers. The information they carry throughout the bloodstream stimulates a wide range of biological processes. He exposed the tadpoles to a range of steroids over different periods of their development, and to his surprise, found that there was no effect on the gonads. A whole lot of time and thought went into these experiments, yet in the end, no measurable difference was observed. A bummer to say the least. But while I was triple-checking tissue samples under the microscope, Hayes was training a creative eye on the disappointing results. What he found was that while none of the steroids had an impact on the sexual development of the tadpoles, some of the steroids had an effect on their growth and subsequent metamorphosis. The most eyebrow-raising effects were observed when Hayes exposed tadpoles to corticosterone. For Hayes, the impact this hormone had on the growth of tadpoles was interesting enough for him to think about throwing his experimental darts in a totally different direction. Corticosterone is a stress hormone. Its equivalent in humans is cortisol. So Hayes put on his frog suit and tried to imagine a stressful scenario for a tadpole. What he came up with was simple enough. A pond starts drying up, and suddenly there are too many tadpoles and not enough water. He hypothesized that a stress response in that situation could be adaptive, meaning that when the tadpole got stressed out by all the other pushy tadpoles and the receding water, its glands would release corticosterone, which would jumpstart the process of metamorphosis and turn its tail into legs. Now the newly minted toad could jump out of the pond and leave all the other tadpole chumps behind. Bingo, adaptation. That was the idea, at least. Turns out, Hayes was mostly right. But as always, how he was wrong was where things get interesting. If the toads-to-be were exposed to corticosterone late in development, it did speed up metamorphosis, allowing for the adaptive, timely leap out of the pond. But if the toads were exposed to the steroid early in development, it actually inhibited their growth. And it had other unexpected negative effects, such as decreasing immune function, diminishing lung function, causing osmoregulatory problems, high blood pressure, and impairing neurological development. If the tadpoles were exposed to corticosterone for a prolonged period of time, the same problems occurred. The tadpoles' stress response to overcrowding was adaptive, but only if it happened at the right time during development. Why was exposure to stress hormones so bad for the younger tadpoles? That's the tricky part. High levels of corticosterone affect the function of other hormones and body systems. For the tadpoles, early and prolonged exposure to corticosterone threw all of these other hormone levels and biological processes out of whack. The effects were maladaptive. Instead of helping the tadpole thrive and survive, the response made things much, much worse. In fact, early exposure often led not only to irreversible developmental changes, but eventually to death. For instance, levels of corticosterone can have an impact on levels of thyroid hormone, which regulates metabolism. In the case of the tadpole,